Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us. A lot of movies to talk about. Then a little bit later this hour, we'll take a focus on film criticism itself and what needs to be done to diversify the ranks of film critics in multiple ways. But first, let me introduce our critics. Joining us today, Charles Solomon, film critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, Yay. Claudia Puig, L.A. Film Critic Association president, and Tim Cogshell, Alt Film Guide, Cinegods.com, film critic. We begin with Christopher Robin, a film that combines live action and animation. It's from Disney. Ewan McGregor stars as Christopher Robin. It's directed by Mark Forster. What'd you think, Charles?
Well, full disclosure, I actually met Christopher Robin a long time ago in London. My friend Susan Goldberg, who's an animation art director and bibliophile, knew every bookstore in London. And when I would visit them, we would go to the mall, and she introduced me once. And this was not a terribly happy man who spent much of his adult life alienated from his father, whom he felt had stolen his childhood and used it to promote and enrich himself. And he grew up having to fight his way through school because, you know, everybody thought he was the little kid in the books. And all I could think about is how much he would have hated this movie, because it turns him his whole life into an extension of his father's fantasies. The CG of the characters is okay. I don't know that it's brilliant, because it's very low-key. They look very old and shop-worn and threadbare, as I guess they should at that point. No Justin pun on threadbare versus teddy bear. The other problem I have with this is that, like Hook, this is telling us, oh, we all need just to be kids again and go back to your stuffed animals and be a child, at a time when the world in general, and I think our country in particular, desperately needs grown-ups.
All right, Charles, not a fan. What do you think, Tim?
Well, you know, I find these movies cute. Exceedingly cute. So cute, you want to smack the stuffing out of that thing. I'm more of a Yogi and Boo Boo kind of guy. That you know, kind of a Grand Larceny kind of bear is my kind of bear. Maybe a little smoky. I wonder if as a child I would have, this storyline, of course, is whole cloth. Just, you know, made up for the movie, but it has all those little things that Winnie would say, you know, about how I find
I'm
it
a
if
bear,
you
a very little brain.
So Christopher Robin,
I found it cloying Meet. And schmaltzy. Yeah, because one of the problems I don't think kids will take to it as much, because it's about a 40-something-year-old man's midlife crisis. First of all, I'm over men's midlife crises. Secondly, I know you're not.
But that's why Larry has
the
sports car.
I'm the lone voice saying that. But okay, even for those who are not, that I don't think children will relate to that. And maybe their parents will. But, you know, that is basically what it's about. It's about Christopher Robin, who has become a workaholic, and he is not paying enough attention to his wife and child. And Winnie the Pooh comes back into his life and teaches him how to be a child again and have fun and cuddle a bear. And I feel like I've seen that story, that, you know, some version of that story. It is Finding Neverland meets Hook.
Yeah.
Well, and talk about a thankless role for the actress who plays his wife.
Yes.
And I'm sorry, I just have to say, this is a ludicrous narrative. What is wrong with going to work? You know, she's all, I got to go to work on the, you have to work on the weekend again? Yeah. You want to eat? You want to pay the mortgage? I'm going to work. I just never understand why the male character in most of these movies just doesn't say, yes, I'm going to work. Cut it out. Leave
I'll
me alone.
I'll see you another day.
Yes. Come on. What do you think's going on here? I'm not playing with that stupid bear anymore.
Yeah. Plus, and how many little kids just want father there as a playmate?
Yes.
You try and get away from your
yes.
parents.
Dad, go to work, for God's sakes. I used to say that all the time. Are you going to work, Dad, please?
Well, it makes me think of Avenue Q, you know, the Broadway puppet show with the bad idea bear on the shoulder giving bad advice. Don't go to work today. Stay home and play.
Christian, this would be okay if it was less tiresome and tedious.
And not quite so slow.
Slow and very just lugubrious.
Christopher Robin, combination animation, live action from director Mark Forster, Alex Ross Perry, Tom McCarthy, and Allison Schroeder are the screenwriters. It's rated PG in wide release. The Spy Who Dumped Me, an action comedy, stars Mila Kunis and Kate McKinnon. It's directed by Susanna Fogel, who co-wrote the screenplay with David Iverson. What'd you think, Claudia?
I liked it. I think the fact that it was directed by Susanna Vogel as opposed to Ghostbusters remake and Ocean's 8 that were directed by men, they're women action comedies directed by men. I think that a woman director kind of gets something extra, and you don't put the women through the male gaze. There's kind of a they're allowed to do everything that not allowed. I shouldn't say that, but they do everything that a man would do in an action comedy, but they do it humorously. I will say that Spy with Melissa McCarthy was a better version of this.
You think?
Yeah.
I like this one better.
Did you? Oh, I like this a lot. I liked it a lot. And what I liked about this one was that it was about a friendship.
Yeah.
And that's the main thing about, you know, when you have these bromance movies or buddy cop movies or buddy anything movies, that's nice. But it's, you don't see very many female friendships. This week we have a couple other movies that are about that. But I liked it. And Kate McKinnon can do anything as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, I thought this movie was just loud. And the reason why I felt it was funnier than Melissa's movies. Melissa does this thing in her movies where she'll stop to do jokes and do a little stand-up routine, and then she'll get back to the movie. they never do that in this movie.
This is integral.
And it just flows. And it is a little Abbott and Costello because, you know, she's the crazy one and she's the slightly
neurotic,
less crazy one.
Yeah.
And what this movie does well, first of all, it's just flat-out funny. They are just killing this dialogue, and I'm just cracking up. They do all the spy stuff, did serious, like Bondi and serious, right? All these handsome men with the jaws and the chins, and they're so serious, and it's all happening. And these ladies, they're bad at the spy stuff to begin with. They're really terrible.
Because they were not spies.
Because they're not spies at all, and they're just stumbling along. But they kind of slowly get the hang of it, you know? And then they put on the makeup, and they get really hot. You know, Mila puts on that dress, and they got those spies and those guns, and they're walking down the hall, and they just become these smoking hot, crazy spy chicks who can do this stuff better than their boyfriends, by the way. And it's just funny, 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 funny. I just giggled all the way through.
I really
movie.
Enjoyed it, too. There's a great showdown scene that happens in a very elegant Viennese tea room. And they basically, it's full of mayhem, and they use everything in that room as a lethal weapon. Yes. Coffee machines,
soccer
plates.
Torts?
Yeah, soccer torts. Yeah. And it's so clever and fun. And I think she does a really good job directing action scenes.
I was going to say, one of the real challenges with this kind of physical comedy is directing it in a way that enhances it being funny. It sounds like you're saying Vogel does that.
Vogel definitely does that. She really has a way with action scenes. There's also a very funny scene where, and I think it's in the trailer, where the women try to hijack a car to get away, and they don't know how to drive a stick because everybody in Europe drives a stick. And it's so fun. So they end up walking next to this car, or the people who own the car.
In that scene.
And that's a familiar gag.
Yeah.
But it's fresh still.
It felt fresh in this particular context.
Because the gag is bigger, and it's bigger in the movie than it is in the trailer. And you watch this gag, and it's still funny in the movie because it's bigger in the movie, and it's just so dumb, and it's just hysterical.
The Spy Who Dumped Me, big hit with our critics, Mila Kunis, Kate McKinnon star, it's rated R in wide release. The sci-fi thriller The Darkest Mind stars Mandla Sternberg and Harris Dickinson. Jennifer Yeh Nelson is the director, Chad Hodge, the screenwriter of the film. Tim?
Yeah. People aren't digging this movie as much as me. I kind of like it. And they're comparing it to the Hunger Games series, which is perfectly ludicrous to me. That's insane to me. So this movie, there's a pandemic. Kills most of the children on the planet. The ones that are left with these sort of odd powers that develop as they grow older, right? As we do, adults, we get afraid of the children. We take them, we house them, you know, for their own good. But what we're really doing is testing them and suppressing. It's very X-Men-y in that kind of way, right? Now, some of these kids escaped being hidden away, and some of them just escaped from housing, and they have this little place, a sort of haven. I think they actually call it Haven in the movie, that all the kids want to go to. Our little hero young woman escapes, joins up with a few other ones, and they're going to make their way to this place. The adults, the government, but mostly just adults, are on their heels as they sort of like figure out their powers and figure out. And this is really great. Now, this is what's great about this movie and different from the Hunger Games movies, those vicious, nasty, ugly Hunger Games movies where they make the kids kill each other. These kids are only protecting each other. They sacrifice themselves for each other. It's the adults who are afraid of them because they know that these kids are better than us in every possible way. And these kids are good. These kids are all nerdy and corny, but I love that about this film. They're not just super, you know, these, you know, sometimes in the movies, these kids are just be these little hero kids anyway. No, these kids are freaky looking. They got, you know, all this kind of stuff. But I love that because those are usually the kind of kids that are brave, the kind of kids that take it in high school. But now you give them a power. And they can do a thing, and you make a movie that's really, really sort of interesting. So For me, is it a little flat sometimes? Sure. Is it a little simple sometimes? Sure. But I like the intention of this film. It's more in line with those Divergent movies, with the wonderful Miss Shailene movie. It has more in common with those.
It sounds like a bit. It has a bit in common with My Hero Academia. That's one of the most popular anime series currently.
You know, these kids are actually heroic. They're not just vicious and.
But you said the movie's not being well received.
No, other people aren't.
You're in the minority on this.
I am a fan
of the film.
It's the YA thing. I think a lot of people are just like tired of YA.
Yeah, it's adapted from a novel.
Yeah.
Actually, I think it is.
Yeah, Alexandra Bracken is the novelist. The film The Darkest Mind, starring Amanda Sternberg and Harris Dickinson, it's rated PG-13. It's in wide release. Also this week, Like Father, it's a comedy streaming on Netflix, starring Kristen Bell, Kelsey Grammer, and Seth Rogen. Lauren Miller Rogen, Seth Rogen's wife, is the writer-director. She makes her directorial debut. Claudia?
This is kind of a breezy movie that also feels predictable and formulaic. I will say that the chemistry between Kristen Bell and Kelsey Grammer works. They do feel kind of believable as father and daughter. Kelsey Grammer is particularly good in it. We haven't seen him in a while, and it's nice to see him.
Very strong and versatile actor.
Yes,
I'd like to see him do more stuff.
I would,
too. He was just on stage here in Los Angeles LA Opera production.
Yes, yeah. So it's not like he hasn't been working. He's been busy. And Kristen Bell is always very likable. I was a big Veronica Mars fan, so I like her as well. And they do have a little song and dance number, which makes use of their talents. It's set on a cruise ship. It feels like product placement for Carnival Cruise Lines, which is not a good thing.
Well, I'm sure it helped with the budget at Carnival.
Yes. the storyline is she's a workaholic. She's left at the altar. Her father had been a workaholic as well and kind of left the family, so she reconnects with him. They go on this cruise after a night of drunken debauchery where they both drink their sorrows away and then find themselves on the cruise the next day that she was supposed to take with her. Her husband on a honeymoon. And actually, some of the people who are the supporting characters are the best ones. There's this kind of Greek chorus of, when you go on a cruise, you're supposed to sit with all these people at meals. So that's the people
This is why I stay in port.
You know, when you go on cruises.
I hated that.
Anyway, it's fine. It's, it's on Netflix, so it's fine to spend a couple hours. It's not something I would, recommend with flying colors, but it's easy to watch, easy to forget.
Mm. Lauren Miller Rogen, the writer director, what did you think of her script and her directing of this?
I thought it was fine. I think the writing left a little to be desired. Some sort of obvious jokes. Is there ever a point in which you're surprised? No, it's all very predictable, but it's kind of enjoyable because these two actors make it a little bit better because they're camaraderie.
I actually squoze. If that's a word, this in late last night, and I liked it ever so slightly more than Claudia. Everything you said, but whenever one of those moments that would come around that was meant to draw a tear, particularly as we worked our way toward the end, got me.
You cried maybe because it was late last night.
Got me, and because Kelsey Grammer is just a really good actor.
He is,
he broke my heart. He was that good on Frasier. I would cry during the episodes of Frasier.
What?
Yeah. Oh, lots of episodes.
Well, the talent in that series was unbelievable, and not just David Hyde Pierce as well. John Mahoney.
Who
isn't with us anymore. But the acting talent and the women. That was the acting.
It was like watching Frasier was like watching a little play.
Yeah, yeah. And the writing is extraordinary. We're talking about a new film with Kelsey Grammer, Kristen Bell, Seth Rogen. Like Father is the comedy. It's streaming on Netflix, and the film is unrated. Just want to remind you that Saturday night, it's our film week screening of Chinatown. Claudia Puig will be joining me on stage afterwards.
Yay.
And I'm looking forward to that. Tim actually joined me for a previous screening we did of Chinatown. We had a great time. It's Claudia's turn, and Robert Town, the great screenwriter of Chinatown, is with us. And at this point, tickets are all but gone. You can check and see if there are just any singletons that might be left at kpcc.org/in-person, but we're all but an official sellout for it. If you got your tickets, we know you'll be there, and we look forward to your joining us at the theater at Ace Hotel. And our screening series will be continuing with screenings coming coming up in the winter and in the spring of next year as we pair that with our Film Week Academy Awards preview to bring you all kinds of fun events with our Film Week critics. We have more reviews to come up here on 89.3 KPCC, including the dramatic comedy Never Going Back with Maya Mitchell and Camila Morone. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. As though we didn't have enough critics in the house, Mr. Chang has just arrived. Justin's going to be with us a little bit later. We're going to talk about the future of film criticism and efforts to diversify film criticism. But right now, we continue with our critics in studio, Claudia Puig, Tim Cogshell, and Charles Solomon. Nico, 1988. Is a biographical drama about the Italian singer. It's written and directed by Susanna Nicarelli. What do you think, Tim?
This is an extraordinary film, my favorite film of the week, about a very interesting person. Played by Trina Durham in this just central performance that is just mind-blowing, right? And she's playing Nico, whose real name was Krista Pofkin. And you know her from the Velvet Underground. She did a couple of recordings with the Velvet Underground. She's a part of Andy Warhol's whole factory set. But what you really know her from is a song that you think is by David Bowie called Heroes. If we could be heroes for just... That's Nico.
That's great. Yeah. Well, glad Tim singing set. Yeah. Yes. Film with.
Yeah, I used to do it.
Critic and Renaissance man.
Really?
That was actually her. She recorded that song. So this film, literally what it says, Nico, 1988. We pick her up. She's about 49 years old. She's on a tour, a sort of very small tour around Europe. And she's a heroin addict, and her son is in an asylum. And she has these few sort of groupies who are hanging around her, and this almost amateur band that's playing with her. And they're all trying to be heroin addicts like her, but they don't know how to do it right, which makes her angry.
Didn't know there was.
You do it like her, you last till you're 50.
Yeah.
And she is just so captivating in this. And there are several performances in this film. She is performing as Nico. And they are just amazing, particularly the one behind the Iron Curtain where they smuggle her in. And no one knows who's actually performing. And behind the Iron Curtain, they've been listening to her records. They know who she is. And they come out and it just... and energizes her, and she performs that song, and that is just an amazing moment.
So
in
the
this movie.
Film really recreated this.
What the movie did, I think, that was so smart was a lot of times with biopics, and particularly with musical biopic or musicians, they tend to focus on their entire life, like from birth to death, and they take on too much. And this just takes on these 2 years, mm-hmm. and it really goes into that. And yes, you know, we kind of knew who Nico was with the Velvet Underground. We don't know this Nico.
No, and that's the thing of the film. She keeps saying that she does these radio interviews, and they tell us about your time with the Velvet Underground. No.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about that.
I want to talk about my music.
Or they'll say, you know, tell us, weren't the 60s the best time in your life? No, we did a lot of LSD.
She has this wonderful line. She asked this guy that she has a hooks up with, am I beautiful? And he's like, no, you look terrible. And she's like,
good.
Yeah. I was unhappy when I was beautiful. And it's like the truth is the deepest truth that she speaks in this movie. Being beautiful was the bane of her existence.
And she says being at the top was empty. Being at the bottom is empty. I mean, she's very nihilistic. She's sort of, you know, exactly what you would think she might be. The Danish actress Trine Dyrholm is magnificent in this. She does her own singing. And she approximates
so it's
the sound.
Not Nico's voice, but she...
No. Yeah, she
but it sounds a lot
with that
like
band.
Her.
Yeah, yeah. And she kills
she
it.
Just gives this unflinching performance, and it captures her inner turmoil. We don't like her necessarily, but we can't take our eyes off of her. And she has this kind of self-destructive charisma like a lot of rockers. Mm. And we've seen a lot of men in these kind of roles, but we don't see many women. So
you think that might be an Oscar nomination?
For me.
I would nominate her.
It's a movie I would nominate. There are these flashback sequences that she has when she does heroin that are done by the filmmaker Jonas Mekas. Who actually made these films of the actual Nico back when she was performing. So when we see these flashbacks and we see her, that's Nico that we're watching in these already edited sequences by this. You know, he's a very famous filmmaker. Look him up. And they're just amazing. And they look like heroin Not that I know. Anyway, stop talking now. Stop talking now.
But, you know, they play one of my favorite 80s songs, Big in Japan, that never got enough attention. And she does a version of it at the end over the credits.
Over the credits, yeah.
And that song has so much resonance because it's about being big in a country outside of your own. And then it's also about heroin addicts, the song itself. So it just has this hypnotic effect. And you find yourself thinking about it days later.
Yeah.
The film is Nico 1988, an Italian biographical drama. Susanna Nicarelli is the director. Trina Duholm is the star of the film with John Gordon Sinclair and Anna Maria Marinka. It's rated R. You can see it at the New Art Theater in West L.A. Night Comes On, a drama that stars Dominique Fishback and John Earl Jelks. It's directed by Jordana Spiro, who co-wrote the screenplay with Angelica Nuando. What'd you think of it, Claudia?
Quite a lot, actually. I thought it was quite good. Jordana Spiro's her first film, and it's an auspicious debut. She did write the script with Angelica Nuando, and who's a spoken word poet, and it's kind of loosely based on Angelica Nuando's experiences in the foster care system. It's about a woman who gets out of juvenile,
detention.
Juvie. Yeah.
What city is this set?
Turning 18.
What city? It feels like it's Northern California.
Yeah, like Oakland-ish.
Oakland, yeah. Anyway, she gets out, and then she has a 7-year-old sister who is in the foster care system. And it's a very, very bleak tale. There's some sisterly love, but it's a tale of revenge, basically. She wants to get back at the father who brutally killed their mother. And first thing she does when she gets out of juvie is buys a gun. So you're sitting there with dread through most of the movie. And the performances, I think, are what really anchor it. Dominique Fishback as Angel is really good, as is the younger girl, Tatum Marilyn Hall. You know, she doesn't have that little kind of precociousness. I mean, there's little elements of that, but they both feel real. Mm. And I thought they were excellent. There was a vulnerability there. It's bleak. It's hard to watch. But I thought it was a very powerful, low-budget drama.
Yeah, kind of beautifully done in every way. Visually beautiful. Visually lovely, too. The sort of cinematography. And it achieves its intention, which is to make us feel the weight of the miseries of this young girl's life. She's just turning 18 when she gets out of detention. And this movie wants us to feel the weight of her, just every little thing. She's angry. She's snippy. So if you think about it, very often we run into young women like this, right? And we see that bit, the way they talk. They're very snippy, very defensive, all that. But we don't get the whole, there's a reason for that.
Yeah, yeah.
She don't talk like, nobody naturally just walks around talking that way. She's carrying the fact
the
that
pain.
She was molested in her first foster care home. She's carrying, and by the way, we learn all of this in the first 5 minutes of the movie. We know that she's just getting out of a year of detention, that she was molested in her first foster care home. We know that her mother has been brutally killed. We know that her father has been charged with the murder. We know that in the first 5 minutes.
The one thing we don't know is where the father lives and if she'll find him.
And that's what she's doing in the movie. She keeps asking for her father's address.
And we will say no more.
And that's it.
All right. It's actually set in Philly is where
movie
is set.
Okay.
Yeah. We're talking about Night Comes On, a new drama that's out starring Dominique Fishback. It's co-written by Jordana Spiro and Angelica Nuando. Spiro is the director, making her directorial debut. It's unrated. You can see Night Comes On at the Lemley NoHo in North Hollywood. Never Going Back, a comedy drama written and directed by Augustine Frizzell. Tim, what'd you think?
I love this movie. This is a messy girls who refuse to participate in polite society movie. Not that they can't, they just won't, because they don't want to. Because it's not doing anything for them, and they're smart, but they're crazy, but deliberately so, because they want a life that's bigger than the one that they're having. They live in, I think they're in like the outs, the burbs of Dallas, and they want to
Fort Worth,
and they work at this diner. And I think they live with her brother, who's and all the boys are way, way worse than them. That's what's so funny in this movie.
They're much more mature than the boys.
Yeah,
they're older than
they
them.
Are perfectly ludicrous, these girls, insane, these girls, silly, these girls, but the boys are still all worse. And they want to go to the beach. They want to go to the beach for
in
that.
Galveston. They don't even
Galveston.
Want to go to Florida.
It's not even a big thing that they want to do. Just go to the beach. But it's just a comedy of just a mess of things that happen, mostly because the one girl just talks the other girl into doing all these wacky things. But she's not – they love each other. They're bananas about each other, and they'll do anything for each other. And so she's not manipulating her. It's just that, you know, and her ideas are just terrible. They're terrible right on the face of them. You can see it right – I mean, right there, it's a bad
you
idea.
You want to reach up and grab the string. Don't do it.
Because I'm rooting for them. But I'm like, but not that. Don't do that. But they do it.
Movie,
but they do it anyway. And I'm like, oh, geez, Willikers. And there's a guy who plays the guy that runs the diner, the older black guy.
Yes. He's fair. I like him.
Love him. And he's like, I love you, girls. You're so wonderful. You're so fired. But you're so wonderful. And he's rooting for him. And that I felt like him.
He was your stand on screen.
Exactly.
Claudia, what'd you think?
I liked it, too. Maybe not with the same level of intensity as you did, but I liked it. Because this is a good week for movies about female friendship. And this is, maybe these girls would grow up and be Kate McKinnon and Mila Kunis in 15 years. Probably not. They might be the women in Broad City.
Wow.
But I thought it was really anchored by their friendship, and there's a kind of a charm because they're vivacious. They do everything wrong, like you say. They have this unlabeled sexuality. They kind of kiss each other, and they also like boys, and it doesn't really matter. They're just good friends. And it's supposedly based on Augustine Frizzell's own youth, which you get because it feels very specific and feels very real. It doesn't feel like, you know, crazy girls. What was that beach movie with?
With the Spring Breakers.
Spring Breakers. Yeah. I mean, it has a few elements of that without feeling quite as extreme and dark as that. Not that this is a cheery movie, but it's, I liked it a lot.
Yeah. It mostly made me laugh.
Yeah.
Never Going Back is the film. It's at the Arclight Hollywood. It's rated R. And again, the feature directorial debut for Augustine Frizzell. Flavors of Youth is a feature anime film from Japan. It's streaming on Netflix. Charles, what'd you think?
A rather uneven anthology. That's three shorts that really don't relate to each other put together. One about a boy who loved having noodles with his grandmother, which is okay, though a little too noodle-oriented. You know, you practically get the recipe for what they shared.
Can you be too noodle-oriented, though? I don't know.
I think so. A second one about a rather ditzy model who is rude to her sister, who turns into a clothing designer who salvages her career, that's quite forgettable. The last one, the most interesting, set in Shanghai, is about a young architect who realizes he blew the love of his life back in high school. The passions of high school in Japan are very important in films, and he tries to go back and listen to a cassette that she made for him. And at one point, he's trying to find a cassette player, and somebody just looks at him and says, "What year do you think this is?" It's okay, but nothing extraordinary.
All right. What will people say? I'm sorry, Flavors of Youth. Flavors of Youth, the Japanese anime film. It's streaming on Netflix. It's unrated. What Will People Say? A Pakistani drama written and directed by Aram Haque. What'd you think, Claudia?
I like this film. I thought it was really powerful. Also, a little hard to sit through because it's painful to watch. It has a really strong lead performance by Maria Mosda, who plays a girl who's grown up in Oslo, but she is the daughter of Pakistani immigrants, and so she's caught between these two worlds, the sort of modern Western world, and her parents are also caught too. They're Pakistani origins, and it's complicated, and yet you find yourself so angry because she is caught in a very normal situation for a young woman with a boyfriend, and she's sent back to Pakistan and wrenched and treated terribly by her father in a number of situations. And yet you still get a certain glimmer of the complexity of the father, too. He's not a complete and utter villain. It's based on the filmmaker's life. She herself was sent back when she was 14. I think it's fascinating. It really gives you a sense of the culture clash. It gives you a sense that institutional sexism starts at home. It's very powerful, and there is a small sense of hope that kind of underlies it. But what I love about the character of Nisha is that she's this unbreakable heroine.
The movie is What Will People Say? Pakistani film. It's unrated. You can see it at Lemley Music Hall in Beverly Hills or Lemley's Playhouse in Pasadena. Coming up, we'll talk about diversity within film criticism. What are people looking for from critics, and in what ways does the field of film criticism need to diversify? Our critics will stay with us. Justin Chang of the LA Times will join us back after this. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. We're delighted to have a full house of critics joining us to talk about our next subject. and that is inclusiveness within film criticism. Last month, USC's Annenberg Inclusion Initiative published a first-of-its-kind study looking at diversity among film critics, and it came to the conclusion that, not surprisingly, most film critics are white men. The study, looking at 20,000 reviews of the 100 top-grossing movies of last year, found white men wrote 64% of the reviews, compared to 18% white women, 14% men of color, and 4% written by women of color. A couple days after that study was released, actress Brie Larson addressed the issue at the Women in Film's Crystal and Lucy Awards, calling for more diversity among film journalists. And she said, it really blanks that reviews matter, but reviews do matter. And she talked about a small film that she did, Room, for which she won the Oscar for Best Actress. But she made a critical point about guys reviewing films that are aimed at women. Justin Chang, L.A. Times film critic, responded to that, taking some issue with it. Justin, thank you for joining us this week.
Thank you, Larry. Yeah, and I want to preface that by saying, you know, I think I agree with pretty much 90 or 95% of what Brie Larson was saying, which is that, you know, we need, I think she said something to the effect of, need to make sure that we're all checking our biases and make sure everyone is in the room. Writing that piece, you know, mansplaining to Brie Larson was the last thing I wanted to do. I hope to, you know, we're all trying to be very sensitive to these things. But I think it did rankle me a little bit, this idea that, you know, because it stems from this idea that she was articulating, which is that she used the example of Ava DuVernay's film, A Wrinkle in Time, saying, you know, I don't need to hear what a 40-year-old white man thought of that movie or what his issues with it were, because the movie wasn't made for him, which I think opens a really interesting bag of worms.
Yeah, the logical extension of that's pretty troubling.
A little bit.
Plus, were there doormen at the theaters to keep other people out of that film if it was just named
for a
woman of color?
But I think you're missing, when you say that, you're missing the larger point. She's saying we need to hear from lots of different people. And I think that's what you were just alluding to, too. She's not saying there's anything wrong with 40-year-old white men. She's just saying.
No, but she did.
She did.
She did. No, I mean, there are two separate issues she was making, one of which totally defensible.
Mm-hmm.
What you're saying, the inclusiveness, the extension. But she also said, essentially, why should I listen to some white guy tell me about A Wrinkle in
Time? She doesn't have to listen, but there should be there needs to be reviews from, you know, women and people of color along with it. So she doesn't,
doesn't,
and if all there is,
the
no, but if that's the majority, and if that's all there is, I hear her point.
Absolutely. I think these two threads run so closely together that you can sort of, you know, it's a danger if you get them, you know, she's saying, I think the point is that we don't need to only hear from white 40-year-old white men. And
exactly.
I don't think anyone would disagree with that.
Right.
Yeah.
Phraseology
is a thing. I think it's fair to say that Ms. Larson was being a little pissy, and I think that's perfectly okay. And she got her phraseology a little. I don't think that she does not want to or will never read a 40-year-old white film critic again. I don't believe that for one second about Ms. Larson.
I think she's directed by 40-year-old white men all the time. Yeah.
So I don't think that's what she means. It's kind of like when we talk about Black Lives Matter, and you know, when certain people say that, they hear one thing, and certain people hear that, you know,
other lives don't matter.
And you know, I don't hear it that way. So I'm okay with what she said. I actually understand her intention. I think that that's all that really matters. Her intention is absolutely correct. Spike Lee actually did say that he, a black person, but specifically he, should direct Malcolm X and not Norman Jewison. Norman Jewison was set to direct Malcolm X. Spike said, no, that movie should be directed by a black person, and frankly, it should be me. Mr. Jewison said, okay, you're wrong about that specifically, but you are right about this. I can make this movie, but you can make it better. You can make a Spike Lee movie. You can make this movie from the perspective of a young black man, and you're 100% right. This movie should be made from the perspective of a young black man. Not that I can't make it. I'm Norman Jewison. But you go ahead and do it. And that was the shape of that conversation. Spike was wrong. Of course, Norman Jewison can make this movie Norman Jewison. But I'm glad Spike made that movie.
All right. Well, I'd love to hear listener thoughts on this about diversification of film criticism. If you're listening to our Friday live show of Film Week in 11 o'clock hour, we're at 866-893-KPCC. You can also comment on our Film Week page at kpcc.org. Charles?
Well, I think everyone agrees, yes, we need a more diverse body of critics. you know, writing about different movies, one question I have is, where are these people going to work? You know, journalism is not exactly a growth industry. When was the last time any major journal added a full-time film critic? At a time when Condé Nast is in trouble, when the New York Post just announced enormous cuts, it's kind of like trying to become an endangered species in some ways.
I do feel like we are all, you know, it's like everyone, of course, is fighting for a very finite number of jobs. That said, I do think there are bright spots here and there. You know, I think Vanity Fair recently hired, you know, Sonia Soraya as their TV critic and Cameron Austin Collins as their film critic, two people of color, both really great critics. And I just yesterday, in fact, the news broke, I don't think these are full-time positions, but I believe RogerEbert.com just hired three female critics, Nell Minow, Thomas Laffley, and Monica Castillo, you know, to join their pool. And they have now achieved, I believe, 50% gender parity. Those, I believe, are, you know, not necessarily full-time staff positions that you would have, like, at a newspaper.
But something important to Chaz Ebert.
Well, I think it's important to talk about this show because, you know, we're the three of you that are here are critics of color.
And female.
And female, exactly.
I'm the 4%.
And the primary reason that you're on the show is you're great critics. But your gender and your racial ethnic background is not irrelevant. One of the things that we've strived for is diversity on the show because different experiences provide, you know, different expertise. One of the things I've really struggled with that I think is every bit as big an issue in film criticism is the lack of conservative representation. You know, when we talk politics on Air Talk, we're bringing in all different points of views. But when we review a documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, there is no conservative critic to offer a thought on that. So many of the documentaries that we have are very much from the left, and we don't really have, and that, as much as I've tried to find an appropriate conservative critic, it's been a real battle. So that too is another issue in criticism.
Well, and Justin, in some of his reviews, has brought in the question of being a person of faith, and
yes,
how many critics cover things from that base? How many critics are gay? How many critics are over, say, 50? That's a large part of the demographic of this country. You know, I don't know what any of those numbers are.
Of course, one of the things that professional critics, anyway, as opposed to people who review films on websites here and there, of which there are many, you know, anybody can set one up, you know, from Harry Knowles on, anybody can do that. One of the things that we are supposed to be doing, because we are trained professional critics, is attenuating our filters. Mm-hmm. We are supposed to be very aware of our filters. I know that I am a sort of liberal, progressive kind of guy. And so when I'm watching Robert Redford's Lions to Lambs, I tap that down. I understand. No, Robert's on my team. So I have to be careful about Robert.
We need to be mindful of our biases.
Thus conservative and religious and all. I do that all the time, particularly. I happen to be an atheist. So I have to be very particular when I watch films that are about and know that about myself. Not everyone who isn't a professional critic even knows that they're supposed to be doing that, let alone is any good at doing
point.
It.
I
wanted to raise the point that that she made about the movie wasn't made for them, because I think that's when she was talking about Wrinkle in Time. I think that's something we need to look at, because, you know, movies aren't necessarily. I'm sure that Ava made it with the intent of having as many people come to the movie. She did not want men not to come. But on the other hand, it was, you know, a movie about a young girl's empowerment. So I hear what Bree is saying in that part of it, but I think we need to be careful about that. On the other hand, we were talking about this beforehand off the air, Tim and I, that men and women sometimes review movies differently. And I think that's something that needs to
parents
be...
Parents and non-parents.
Yes, right.
No, and just to extend your point, I think in the case of A Wrinkle of Time, how many young girls pay any attention to film criticism, right? Yeah. I mean, so film criticism almost by definition is a pre-selected audience.
Yes.
And critics are keeping, when we review Christopher Robin, we're not reviewing it for six-year-olds, right?
Which is the direct audience it may be
aimed
at. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We'll continue our conversation. I love talking with our critics about all this stuff. We're going to continue with all four of them. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Our film critics just
kept right on going, even with the break. We're going to get them back into the conversation. Let me reintroduce our critics who are joining us. Justin Chang, Los Angeles Times film critic. Claudia Puig, who's the president of the L.A. Film Critics Association. Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Synagogues. And Charles Solomon, Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We're talking about efforts to diversify film criticism, to have more experiences, more voices included in the process. Roberto in Brea said, it's very important to get more people of color into film criticism, but I'd also like more diversity of ideological perspective. That's Roberto in Brea. Let's talk with Marisa in Monterey Park. You're on Air Talk. Or Film Week, I'm sorry.
Hi. As an artist, a Latinx artist, I felt the need for diversity and criticism very viscerally when I was listening to Air Talk review of Coco. So I felt that the reviewers really lacked the cultural competence to talk about the film.
Claudia whispered, he's talking about me.
No, I wasn't. Yeah. You should have had me on the show. Yeah. I wasn't doing it that day. Yeah.
I agree.
And what's funny, because the critics all raved about Coke. That's one of the best, if not the best, reviewed film of the year. So what was missing from that?
On Air Talk that day, and I know that I'm not the only Latinx in L.A. that was just screaming at my radio that day, was they focused on how morbid skeletons are, and wasn't it a wonder that Pixar could, you know, take these morbid figures and make them so lively and fun? And that was a direct lack of cultural competence.
Excuse me, I think I did some of the talking about that, and what I said, not that skeletons are morbid, but that they're hard to animate because they have to remain rigid or they don't look like skeletons, and that they made the characters so endearing in part by using the dark space around their eyes.
So. All right, Marisa, thanks for your call. We're at 866-893-KPCC. So, yeah, there's a good example. So does there have to be a Latino film critic to review Coco?
Well, Black Klansman is coming up.
Mm-hmm. I'm seeing it today.
Spike Lee movie with the word black in it and Klansman. And I'm not on the show on the 10th. But I'm okay with that. And to be honest with you, every now and again when I run into someone and they look at me sort of directly and say, what do you think of Black Klansman? And I'm like, I have a beat where I'm like, why did you ask me that?
Yeah. Well, Crazy Rich Asians is coming up. So, you know.
I'm a Klansman because I'm black. From whence does the question come? And it's a silly thing, but there it is.
But, you know, on the other hand, yes, it is. But there were somebody approached me from Remezcla, which is a Latino site, and they said, can you review Coco for us? I said, I'd be happy to. And they said, can you talk to some of your other Latinx colleagues? And I don't have any because I'm the lone Latina in the LA Film Critics. And
you're the lone Latina in the whole mm-hmm. film critics organization?
In ours, yeah. 60 people.
In Los Angeles?
In Los Angeles, yeah. I'm it.
Wow.
So that's sad.
Not even Spanish language media has a film critic. So like La Opinion has no film critic.
They
wow.
didn't go to La Opinion. They did. Monica Castillo, who works for Washington Post and used to work for New York Times and is now going to work for Roger Ebert, was called upon. And Carlos... there are a few other people in town. Nestor Betancourt was featured in this article, but, you know, not enough, not nearly
yeah.
enough.
So what do you think the barrier is?
Well, some of what Charles was saying, that people aren't getting hired and they aren't working for sites or publications that are noticeable enough, that are prominent enough.
Or are they just, if you're writing in Spanish language, does that in some way isolate you from, for want of a better term, the mainstream? If your writing is only being read in Spanish, does that limit your audience or your access to things like film critics groups?
Yes, I mean, I'm not even talking about the ones that write in Spanish. I'm talking about people like me who are a Latin background who write in English, because that opens up a whole other can of worms.
No, yeah.
But
Well, and also just to, you know, we should talk a little about the film festival angle on this. One of the things that Brie Larson was doing when she gave her speech was talking about how announcing the news that the Sundance and Toronto film festivals have pledged a certain number of their press accreditations to, you know, diverse critics, critics of color, women, women critics.
I can attest to that. I just got a direct invitation from Toronto. I haven't covered it in years, and they invited me directly, probably because of that.
And that is important because a lot of these films begin their journey at film festivals. That's where the press coverage begins. And I certainly, my colleague Trevelle Anderson recently did a big report on this and talked to a lot of people. And, you know, the kind of the shutting out of you know, diverse media, you know, people who write for predominantly black publications, for example, not getting access into the screening, not being bypassed on the red carpet. These things, you know, there is a systemic issue here.
There's people who are ghettoized. Yeah.
And is that a result of the size of the publications or sites that they write for? What is it that the larger publications like the LA Times, there isn't as much?
The LA Times and the trades and the New York Times, of course, you know, are going to get most of the access first. I mean, I believe that, you know, one journalist recently, was it at the Emmys backstage, you know, asked Sterling K. Brown, right? Was it who, you know, who would won an Emmy for This Is Us, you know, did you know that, you know, this happens to a lot of, you know, a lot of black journalists? And he kind of said, no, and now I'm going to be more mindful of this.
It's consciousness raising time. Yeah. I mean, that's what we're doing.
All right. Deepa writes on the page, a diverse group of critics gives me a well-balanced understanding of the movie. They bring their personal experiences, some of which are close to mine. That helps me appreciate my movie options better. If Critic A says it's, I related to it, then I know I won't, because Critic A views and experiences are very unlike mine. That's a really interesting point, because I think for many of us, the critics that we identify with, they're sort of we sort of align ourselves. We know I'm more typically with that critic, or don't share the view of that critic, and so their experience is related to
I'm a Roger Ebert man more than the Gene Siskel man.
But
look at that. I'm identifying with two white men. Middle-aged white men. I was a kid growing up. It would have been great. I started reading Pauline Kael later and realized I had way more in common with her.
Yes.
And so on. And you know, David Ehrenstein, who's in our group, and I realized, oh, I got a whole lot in common with him. both black, both Jews. Yeah. Nevertheless, I never stopped being a Roger Ebert man. You know, I didn't stop identifying with the middle-aged white dude.
Is that something that comes from their writing and their perspective, or from a shared experience of being in Ehrenstein's experience, both being black?
And some of it is that direct shared experience, but I found that with Roger Ebert specifically, because I started reading him when I was a little kid, when I was a young person, and I could see that he was all sweet, sweet backs, a badass song. I could see that he dug into that movie. He didn't have anything to do with that culture, but he knew something was going on. And he made a point of understanding what was going on, which is why he reviewed that movie very well. Lots of black exploitation films, for that matter, if you read Roger's writing about
black exploitation. Well, and this relates, I think Jackie in Hollywood says, I think it's really about context. Do you have the context, the background, when you're reviewing a film and the topics that it raises? And that it has to do with critics educating them. So, you know, when you folks come in and you talk about a film that's set in a particular milieu, You've spent a little time studying it, learning about it. See, you know, how accurate or not is the depiction? What are the references that are part of that? And that's part of being a competent critic. Thank you all so much. Great to talk with you. We appreciate it. Justin Chang, Claudia Puig, Charles Solomon, Tim Cogshell, all joining us on Film Week. We'll be back with you, of course, next week for our Friday at 11, Saturday at noon broadcasts of Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. And if you're coming to the Saturday night screening of Chinatown Theater at Ace Hotel, 7 o'clock, we sure look forward to seeing you there. Have a great weekend.